conservatives pushing the fantasy that what they need is some kind of elected dictator without any of the post-war checks or balances that they used to think were at the core of democracy and who, by some act of magic, would solve the difficult crises around them. And yet Truss is in many ways an unlikely candidate. While some have compared her to Margaret Thatcher, who paved the way for the Conservatives' post-1979 hegemony by defeating the country's unions, privatizing much of the welfare state and making privatization briefly a popular cause, a much more likely comparison is Theresa May, who was welcomed into office with press headlines predicting a period of authoritarian right-wing government, crush the saboteurs, only to be defeated at the first moment she had to test those policies on voters. A choice between austerity and populist bigotry is a brutal one, and it portends a bleak immediate future for government in the UK.
CIA in Indonesia.
Part 1.
The newly independent country is struggling in a deadly civil war. The rebels use a variety of armed weapons against the central government. They even enjoy an air force and aircraft bombing. It seems that the rebels are being supported by a powerful ally, an ally that is unknown to the Indonesian government and army. But on May the 18th, 1958, an incident takes place which reveals the reality behind this secret. One of the rebels' bombing aircraft is hit and falls. The pilot is found alive by the Indonesian army. Alan Pope, the pilot of the aircraft, is American. This news shocks everyone. What is on the mind of everyone is why America should be involved in overthrowing Indonesia's first government after its independence. Especially since Indonesia's government was in good terms with America.
The town of Bandung is an attractive place high up in the hills of Western Java. It's here that the Afro-Asian Conference is being held, and worldwide attention is drawn to the scene of this unique meeting. President Sukarno of Indonesia, arriving to attend one of the last sessions, evidently had quite a reception. Arab countries were among the 29 nations taking part in the discussions, and the talks covered a wide field.
Most countries attending the Afro-Asian Conference were fledgling states who had just gained their independence. The aim of the conference was to establish economic and cultural ties between Asia and Africa. It was in this conference that the initial idea of the non-aligned movement came about, and it was established a few years later in the former Yugoslavia in 1961. The conference was in fact a message to the East and West blocs. The members of the conference suggested a world movement whose members could envision their future without the interference of Moscow or Washington.
It is a new departure in the history of the world that leaders of Asian and African peoples can meet together in their own countries to discuss and deliberate upon matters of common concern. Yes, there is diversity among us. Who denies it? But again, what harm is in diversity when there is unity in desire? This conference is not to oppose each other. It is a conference of brotherhood.
But it is interesting that all the efforts of Sukarno and fellow members of the conference were interpreted as communist tendencies by Washington. Only a few days after the Afro-Asian conference, the White House ordered the CIA to be ready. This order was revealed 40 years after it was issued, and it was to punish Sukarno, or better yet, to overthrow him. The White House gave the authority to the CIA regarding Sukarno. It ranged from bribing the voters to supporting the opposition groups and even assassinating the Indonesian president. But what had prompted the White House to adopt such hostile measures against Sukarno? It seems that Indonesia's colonial past was to blame. From the 16th century, when the first Dutch ship reached the shores of Indonesia, till 1945, this country was a colony of the Dutch Empire. After World War II, many countries, including Indonesia, struggled to gain independence. In the 50s, Indonesia was the fifth most populated country in the world, with a population of 80 million. In 1927, Ahmed Sukarno, with his like-minded friends, established a pro-independence party, the Indonesian National Party, PNI, of which Sukarno was elected the first leader. Two years later, he was arrested and spent a year in prison. After his release, he was once again arrested in 1933 in Jakarta by Dutch police and sent to exile for almost 12 years. Sukarno was still in exile when the Japanese invaded the archipelago in 1942. 3 days after Japan's surrender in World War II, on the 18th of August 1945, Sukarno officially declared the basic governmental structure of the new Republic of Indonesia. After the end of World War II, the Dutch, with the help of the British, tried in vain to return to their centuries-old colony, but they were met with the defiance of the Indonesian people. In the end, the Dutch were forced to accept the independence of Indonesia.
In the Royal Palace at Amsterdam, the transfer of sovereignty creating a new independent republic, the United States of Indonesia, has been completed. Queen Juliana, attended by her ministers and in the presence of members of the States General, was the first to put her signature to the document. Mr. Mohammed Hatta, the Indonesian Prime Minister, signed the Act of Transfer and the Statute of the Netherlands-Indonesian Union. Mass meetings at many places in Java and Sumatra called upon the people to present a united front to the Dutch and their allies. And the claim has insistently been made that Indonesia has already established itself as a self-governing state. The leader of the movement, which, as I've said, is centered in Java, is Dr. Sukarno.
That is how Ahmad Sukarno was lovingly referred to by the people of Indonesia as the father of the nation. Sukarno, with his struggle for independence of Indonesia and also initiation of the non-aligned movement, showed the White House that he will not be a submissive leader in the Far East for the Americans. And worse still, he does not recognize the New World Order. But for the Americans, it was not too hard to find a pretext for hostility against Sukarno. The Indonesian Communist Party freely operated in the country. Sukarno had allowed the party to operate freely due to the fact that they had the right to do so under the democratic framework. This was at a time when a powerful trio was at the helm of the White House. Eisenhower, Allen Dulles, and John Foster Dulles. These three knew well how to eradicate any nationalist and independence movement under the pretext of fighting against communism. The Americans had discovered that Indonesia had 20 billion barrels of oil reserves. And a leader like Sukarno with such nationalist ideas would not allow American companies to get their hands on such a national treasure. They had to stop him on his tracks before it was too late. After visiting the United States, Sukarno visited the Soviet Union and China. And when the Americans declined to sell him weapons, he sought to buy them from East European countries. Yet Sukarno constantly endeavored to strike a balance between the army and political parties to maintain his country's stability. And the Communist Party was one of those political parties active in Indonesia. This was enough for the Americans to see the time and conditions right to overthrow Sukarno. A CIA operative in Indonesia informed his bosses that Sukarno insists on the involvement of the Indonesian Communist Party in the governance of the country. Sukarno's justification for this was that 6 million people voted for the party in the July 1957 elections, and the party held the third place of power in the country. Everything was ready for the Communist Phobia project to start. On the 30th of November the same year, a grenade was thrown at Sukarno in front of a school. He escaped the assassination attempt unharmed, but 10 people were killed and 48 children were injured. The CIA blamed the communists for the assassination, but later it was discovered that the assassination had no connections with the Communist Party. Finally, the Americans' project started. On the 1st of August 1957, the CIA's report in the National Security Council created a commotion. Allen Dulles stated that Sukarno had reached a point of no return. And Frank Wisner, head of the CIA's Directorate of Plans, a clandestine intelligence unit, stated that it was time to halt Sukarno's feet over fire. Al Ulmer, chief of the Far East Division of the CIA's Directorate of Plans, believed that the rebels in Sumatra must be armed and organized so that they could take control in the capital city and put an end to the communists' gain of power. Very early in the case. According to CIA documents, on the 25th of September, President Eisenhower ordered Alan Dulles to carry out a coup in Indonesia. It only took 3 months to plan the operation in detail. A huge operation room was created in the southeast of Asia, and all top CIA figures were present there. They contacted some of the rebel leaders in Sumatra who called themselves Permesta. To carry out this operation, which was the CIA's most ambitious mission at that time, the U.S. Army trained and armed tens of thousands of Indonesian rebels. The U.S. Navy, which patrolled the waters of the Sumatra shoreline, unloaded telecommunication equipment on the beach. The U.S. Air Force provided hundreds of thousands of weapons, which were enough to arm 8,000 soldiers, and most importantly, 15 B-26 Invader aircraft were made ready for combat. Everything was prepared for the overthrow of Sukarno. On the 10th of February, Indonesian rebels declared their existence through a newly founded radio station supported by the CIA. The rebels gave a 5-day deadline for the Communist Party to be declared illegal and a new administration to take office.
First films of the Civil War in Indonesia. Airborne forces of the central government are flown into Sumatra, the main island rebelling against the government of President Sukarno. Paratroopers hit the silk. Their target, rich American-operated oil fields seized by the rebels. At the same time, government troops move in by sea.
On the 21st of February, the Indonesian Navy destroyed the rebels' radio stations in the heartland of Sumatra and seized their positions in the shoreline. CIA officers and American mercenaries fled farther inland into the jungles of Sumatra. As the conditions worsened for the rebels, CIA commanders summoned their pilots to the Clark Air Base. Their aim was to help the rebels hit governmental targets and to provide military and logistic support to the rebels. The bombing started on the 19th of April, 1958. One of the CIA pilots that took part in this mission was Alan Lawrence Pope. He carried out his first mission in Indonesia on the 27th of April. In the next 3 weeks, he and his compatriots bombarded military and civilian targets in villages and ports across Indonesia. The U.S. Embassy's report on the bombings confirms that hundreds of civilians were killed in the attacks. In the final days of April, Sukarno's forces managed to completely defeat the Sumatra rebels, and in the midst of the conflict, 5 CIA officers who were in Sumatra fled to the jungles. Yet the aerial bombardment continued. In the early hours of Sunday, 18th of May, Alan Pope was carrying out a covert bombing mission in Indonesia. While flying over the Ambon Island sky, he sank an Indonesian Navy ship, bombed a marketplace, and destroyed a church. At this point, the B-26 Invader Pope was piloting was shot by anti-aircraft artillery, and the aircraft caught fire at 6,000 feet. Pope had his identification documents, his mission reports, and Clark Air Base pilot card in his pocket. These documents identified him as an American pilot. Pope jumped out of his aircraft with a parachute and was caught by Indonesian government forces. In the afternoon of the same day, a report was sent to CIA headquarters declaring Pope's disappearance. The next day, Alan Dulles sent a telegraph message to CIA operatives in the Philippines, Taiwan, and Singapore. Abort mission. Destroy the evidence and retreat. No one in Washington could have imagined that the operation would end the way it did.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Limelight. Senator Ron Johnson, a Wisconsin Republican, called Mar-a-Lago a pretty safe place to keep documents with sensitive information on Friday, 12th of August. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Fatima Khaled. The article has been published by Newsweek and is titled Ron Johnson calls Mar-a-Lago a pretty safe place for classified documents. Senator Ron Johnson, a Wisconsin Republican, called Mar-a-Lago a pretty safe place to keep documents with sensitive information on Friday, 12th of August. I'm not overly concerned about some top-secret information being leaked out, Senator Ron Johnson told ABC News affiliate WSIN, adding that while he is always concerned about classified documents, he thinks that the documents in the possession of former President Donald Trump are in a secure location guarded by the Secret Service. However, the Secret Service said that it used to conduct physical screenings to ensure no banned items were brought into Mar-a-Lago and to secure the then president, but it didn't decide who was given access to the residence when Donald Trump was in office, Reuters reported on Saturday, 13th of August. Additionally, an unidentified former U.S. intelligence officer described the place's security as a nightmare, according to the Reuters news agency. "It's a nightmarish environment for a careful handling of highly classified information," the former intelligence officer said. Meanwhile, former intelligence officer Rebecca Koffler also called Mar-a-Lago a counterintelligence nightmare on Sunday, 14th of August, during an appearance on Fox News Channel. Mar-a-Lago has been a porous place ever since Donald Trump declared his candidacy and started winning primaries several years ago, said Aki Peretz, a former CIA counterterrorism analyst, according to CNN. Aki Peretz added, "If you were any intelligence service, friendly or unfriendly, worth their salt, they would be concentrating their effort on this incredibly porous place." The FBI, with the approval of Attorney General Merrick Garland, carried out a search warrant of Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort residence on Monday, looking for top-secret and sensitive compartmentalized information, as well as other classified documents. The Washington Post reported on Thursday that records relating to nuclear weapons were sought by the federal agents, but Donald Trump has described that reporting as a hoax. Earlier this week, sources told Newsweek that the search was mainly carried out after authorities received a tip from an informer who identified the type of highly classified documents that were still in Donald Trump's possession and where they were located. Still, Senator Ron Johnson said on Friday that Donald Trump had already declassified the information. The last few days of office, former President Trump declassified a batch of materials. "Hopefully, we're going to try and get that information. We have not seen a page of that," the Republican senator from Wisconsin said. However, former Justice Department official Mary McCord said that she couldn't find a plausible argument that he had made a conscious decision about each one of these to declassify them before he left office, according to the Reuters news agency. Mary McCord added that the former president had no power to declassify information after leaving office. Donald Trump's office told Just the News this week that the ex-president had a standing order to declassify sensitive information so he could move it to his Florida home from the White House. Some legal experts said that Donald Trump could have violated the Espionage Act, a law that penalizes its violators by up to 10 years imprisonment, or a fine, or both, by holding onto the documents. Meanwhile, Donald Trump's handling of requests to turn over classified documents may have made a case against him quite strong, according to former U.S. attorney Renato Mariotti. Renato Mariotti wrote about the potential legal cases facing the former president in a Politico website column published on Sunday. Mariotti previously served as a federal prosecutor in the U.S. attorney's office for the Northeastern District of Illinois, where he specialized in cases involving white-collar crime, fraud, and tax evasion. In his column, Renato Mariotti said that the Department of Justice's attempt to show deference to Trump in requesting the return of classified documents may have led to the ex-president digging himself into a deeper legal hole. By allegedly withholding some documents after initial requests, Donald Trump may have helped make a potential case against himself for violating the Espionage Act quite strong. That statute, along with one of the other statutes cited in the search warrant, required the prosecution to prove willfulness, Mariotti wrote. In other words, they required the government to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant intended to break the law. it will be difficult for Donald Trump to claim that he did not realize that the records he kept were national security secrets that rightfully belonged to the government, given that the government repeatedly told him so and demanded the return of the documents.
Hidden Files. Have you heard about the billionaire space race? What about Harvey Weinstein's abuse case? Or the Trump supporters' takeover of the U.S. Capitol? Well, chances are that you have. When it comes to major stories from mainstream media, the world is certainly a small place where the news is heard loud and clear. But in the cacophony of these major stories, there are many voices that are hushed. Stories that seem as small as a single ordinary person and yet are as large as a community, a major city, or even a nation. Hello, and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and today, in this new program, I'd like to take a pledge to provide you with a rare glimpse of news that seldom make the news, or stories that don't fit the mainstream plot, and of voices that are silent. But before we go further, let me tell you a personal story that doesn't only belong to me, one in which, had things gone differently, I would likely not be here with you today, and neither, perhaps, with the idea of this program, a story that started some 3 years ago with my arrest in the U.S.
It's just past 7:30 in the morning over here in the Iranian capital. You're going to have to begin this bulletin with a shocking development. Press TV's news anchor, Marzia Hashimi, has been detained and imprisoned in the United States with no formal charges. Ms. Hashimi was arrested in a St. Louis airport and has now been transferred to a Washington, D.C. facility by the FBI. The reason for her arrest, as I just said, remains unclear up to this moment. She was visiting the United States to visit her ill brother, who was terminally ill, I've been hearing, and of course visiting her other relatives. Ms. Hashimi has informed her family members of her ill treatment in detention. Hashimi, a Muslim woman, was born in the United States and is an American citizen.
Such stories of being kidnapped and arrested without charge are so surreal that it's hard to believe that it can happen to you. Until, of course, it does. Growing up as a black American, studying journalism as a student and later as a convert to Islam, I heard and read this happened to many others, of course, but I never thought that I myself could end up being kidnapped and arrested. And that's exactly the point. The numbers speak for themselves.
Mass incarceration in the United States definitely has a racial component to it. According to the United States Sentencing Commission, black male offenders receive sentences on average 19.1% longer than similarly situated white male offenders. In addition, black men are 6 times more likely to be incarcerated than white men. Following is the lifetime likelihood of imprisonment for U.S. residents born in 2001.
With me understanding well the history of policing and the judicial system in the United States, when I was arrested, I knew that anything could happen to me. I knew that there were political prisoners in the country who were still incarcerated after 40 years and had spent most of those years in solitary confinement. Though the United States denies having any political prisoners, I knew how people had been framed for so many offenses. Now, my case was quite unique in another aspect. That is, unlike the many black men, Muslims, and activists, I had a decent following as a media personality here at Press TV. So the station kicked off an awesome information campaign about what was happening, and social media groups went into full gear getting the word out. I didn't know about all this from the inside of prison, of course, but I did see that my treatment was quickly improved, and then in a matter of days, I was released without charge. But I don't know of anyone else who has been this blessed. It's not uncommon for black men, for Muslims, and for activists to spend years in prison, at times in solitary confinement, without there being a shred of honest evidence against them. Many end up pleading guilty as they are not told that they will not be released unless they plea bargain and spend some years in prison. So it's only fair for me to use this platform to speak about those whose cases haven't received this kind of public attention, like fellow Americans whose country claims to be the vanguard of protecting human rights around the world, when in actuality it often falls quite short of defending human rights even according to its own constitution. Well, I'd like to bring in my special guest for this program. Welcome, and Dr. Cynthia McKinney to Hidden Files.
Dr. Cynthia McKinney. As a member of the Democratic Party, Dr. McKinney served 6 terms in the U.S. House of Representatives starting from 1993. McKinney left the Democratic Party and ran in 2008 as the presidential candidate of the Green Party of the United States. She is a major critic of U.S. policy as it is related to Israel and was part of a Gaza relief boat to help to get basic supplies to the Palestinian people of Gaza. The boat was attacked by the Israeli Navy. McKinney introduced legislation to have the government release information about the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. She has also introduced legislation demanding the release of government information regarding the murder of Tupac Shakur.
Thanks so much for being with us. It's a pleasure having you. Well, I'd like to start off in looking at the situation. I mean, it was amazing what happened to me and the way it went down, Cynthia. And it appears what we're seeing is the erosion of the Constitution. Your thoughts about this, and how exactly is this happening? What's going on?
Well, I think what has happened in the United States is that over the years, we've had a gradual shifting in even the kind of governance system that exists inside the United States. So there was a time when the Constitution was the primary law of the land, and people spoke about constitutionalism. The Bill of Rights was something that rolled off the tongues of everyone, and if a law or a particular behavior was unconstitutional, it was challenged. But gradually what happened is that we saw the erosion of not just, of constitutionalism and of the Bill of Rights itself. And so a situation like what happened to you, which is unconscionable in a country that prides itself on freedom and due process and justice. But now no one's rights are guaranteed. And so you've got people who went to the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, and they are in solitary confinement. Many of them have been in solitary confinement for months now. And the situation has changed. I believe what has happened is that there has been a coup against the U.S. Constitution. And the average, ordinary U.S. citizen doesn't realize that the constitutional protections that have been guaranteed for centuries really are no longer protecting the people of the United States. And the average, ordinary U.S. citizen doesn't realize that the constitutional protections that have been guaranteed for centuries really are no longer protecting the people of the United States.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting what you said. I mean, your thoughts overall on the role of the mainstream media in misinforming people about that reality of constitutional law and the basic rights that Americans once had, but they no longer do.
We used to have media. Well, actually, there was a time when we had real media. And even though that media had its own sort of vested interest or special interest in and of itself, you could at least get half of the story from U.S. Media. It's Walter Cronkite, and that's the end of the story. Or you'd have the other fella on radio, and he'd say, and now the rest of the story. So there was always a way to dig a little bit deeper, and we had investigative journalists who were given the opportunity to hone their craft with the problems around governance. So you even had, say, for example, the Washington Post with Watergate. It was the Washington Post that broke the story.
Right.
Now the Washington Post covers up because it's been purchased indirectly by the CIA by way of Jeff Bezos and a $600 million contract for various things that Bezos was able to get by way of Amazon. So you've got a situation now where we don't even have alternative, we don't have responsible corporate media, we don't have alternative media because now the foundations have stepped in, and you've got George Soros, who's pouring money into the Democratic Party, pouring money into alternative media. You've got already the other foundations, the Rockefeller Foundation and other foundations, pouring money into alternative media. So what used to be that, or what used to provide that critical analysis of what actually is happening in our political system and who is benefiting and who is losing, you don't have those questions even asked any longer. And so therefore, we've also had a situation where the courts in the United States have said that it's okay for the media to knowingly lie to its consuming audience. So now you've got legalized lying, you've got an end of investigative journalists, you've got the concentration of ownership of the media, both alternative and sort of corporate. And so now, basically, I think it was Mark Twain who said, even back then, he said that, you know, the more education you have, if you get your information from the regular media, then you're misinformed. Well, yeah, you're misinformed, and vast numbers of people in the United States are misinformed because they get their media from what they think are trusted sources, but they're no longer trusted.
What's your perspective on the internet being controlled and how that can affect people who are actually searching for the truth?
The shame of it all is that the internet itself and the research and development that gave us quote-unquote social media was paid for by U.S. taxpayers. For these should be, as are the airwaves for that matter, should be public resources. But there's very little public in the public resources that have been privatized. Well, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said we need a revolution of values. And I would agree with that, talking about the United States. I would just say that we need a revolution, and that would probably end it full stop. I would end it full stop. We need to do away with everything that we know, because it took a turn. And the turn that it took has been to the detriment of the people. It has been to the detriment of truth. It has been to the detriment of justice. It has been to the detriment of peace. We haven't had peace since I was an adult. And now I'm entering my senior years. And we still don't have peace. And in large measure, it's because of the belligerent policies of the United States of America. So we need to build new institutions, and they can exist alongside the current ones, but eventually we've got to get rid of the current institutions that no longer work for the people and no longer represent what they are supposed to be.
Well, when we look at the situation, I mean, Cynthia, both of us are American, and neither one of us are living in the United States because of various reasons now. But when we look at the situation, the increase of censorship and pressure as far as the taking away of being able to have freedom of speech, I mean, what's happening? Where are we going with this?
Unfortunately, and there's so many more who are laboring inside the United States in jobs that they don't like, jobs that don't respect them, jobs just in order to make ends meet. And they, you know, for example, you have, I guess I shouldn't name, but I have followed many of the professors who are inside the United States, and they've been punished because of their belief system. And one of them is a Palestinian American who had a job offered to him, and then the job was snatched away from him when he put something on Twitter, and it's a shame. We have another professor who wrote a very internationally acclaimed book. That book was about the Holocaust, and he told me, Cynthia, I haven't worked since then. And that's probably been about 10 years ago, 10 or maybe 15 years ago now. So people are being punished. People are suffering in their own ways because the diminution of rights and the Bill of Rights is not a document that is living and breathing in the United States any longer.
Where do you see all this going? I mean, what has to happen in your perspective?
Well, you know, people outside sort of look at you askance when you say, well, you know, I'm much more comfortable outside of the U.S. than I am inside the U.S. And people don't like outside because the United States is something, it's a dream. It's something to be aspired to. To live inside the United States. Every child's goal in life in certain countries is to be able to get a job in the United States, to be culled by the great culling machine and then leave one's country in the brain drain and go and help make private organizations like Google and Facebook more wealthy than they already are. The world has been turned upside down. Our values have been turned upside down, and the system is rigged, and it's rigged internationally as well. That's not just a inside the United States kind of thing. It's been rigged for hundreds of years. How do we unrig ourselves? I was at an anti-war protest, and I ended my speech by saying, "We shall take our country back." And then I thought about it for a while, and I said, I've been participating in anti-war speeches for 20 years, and we still haven't taken our country back, and we haven't ended the wars. After last anti-war speech with the anti-war crowd that I was with. Those are my people. And I thought about it, and I said, you know, I've been protesting for 20 years. I've been saying we're going to take it for 20 years, and it hasn't happened yet. So what's the missing ingredient? When Trump said that the system is rigged, it was right. It was accurate. It was an accurate statement of that people in the U.S. find with their governance system now. What was left out of that analysis, though, was what has happened to the people since. I believe that for hundreds of years, as the system was being rigged, the people of the United States adjusted to the rigging of the system, and so they adjusted themselves. They themselves became rigged along with the rigged system. The only way we can actually have values that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. talked about is that we've got to unrig ourselves. We've got to dig deeply within ourselves and understand who we are, where we are, what our country has lost, and how we can get it back. Finally, the other thing is that not only in this sort of rigging and unrigging, the system has never, the United States has never dealt with some issues like the race issue. And race is easily used. It's the kindling that is always there, that all one has to do is throw a match that has been, but it still has a little spark. And that spark is enough to just combust the entirety of the United States. That is something that has to stop. And if it doesn't stop, we will never unrig ourselves, and we will never have the revolution of values that we need, and we will never take our country back.
Well, Dr. Cynthia McKinney, thank you so much for being with me. It has been a pleasure speaking to you here, Hidden Files. The way the alternative media led this fight for my freedom and the way that on social media, hashtag Free Marzia Hashemi went viral were very effective campaigns and say a lot about the potential for alternative voices to play a bigger role in highlighting what is really taking place on the ground globally. Well, let's take a look at some of the actions held around the world during the Free Marzia Hashemi campaign.
Free, free Marzia!
Free, free Marzia!
Free Marzia Hashemi!
Free Marzia Hashemi!
Free, free Marzia!
Free, free Marzia!
Marzia Hashemi should be free!
Marzia Hashemi should be free!
She's African American. She's a woman. She's a Muslim. She has a conscience. She is intelligent. She is a journalist, and she is exposing America's dirty laundry.
Whether it's Trayvon Martin, whether it's Eric Garner, whether it's the people being starved to death in Yemen, or people being bombed in Pakistan, or people being killed in Gaza, or people being killed in Libya, Marcier's concern for humanity is that we live in peace.
Just because it's legal doesn't mean it's moral. Just because it's legal doesn't mean it's right. Just because it's legal doesn't mean it's just.
Free, free Hashemi!
Free, free Hashemi!
Free, free Hashemi!
Free, free Hashemi!
Up in arms on the streets of Tehran, anger today over the detention of a prominent journalist. Marzia Hashemi is an anchor for Iran's English language state broadcaster, Press TV, and she's American.
It's a mixed bag.
Christened Melanie Franklin, born in New Orleans to Protestant parents. And inspired by the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Hashemi converted to Islam and changed her name. Her colleagues are demanding her return. Hashemi's boss says she's been mistreated while in custody and has done no wrong.
This is not an acceptable reason to make Marzia as a political pawn in a political play, in a political war with Iran.
What my experience has shown me is that we can and must try to magnify the voice of the voiceless, and we can be effective. We have to dig into files that others don't want to touch, cases that have been ignored because it just wasn't in their interest to portray. And this program is a start. Here, together, we can inspect, inform, and ignite the change that needs to take place so that more stories can have a happy ending like mine, so that people like you and me can have a chance at living a life as a person and not be reduced to yet another statistic, another number. God willing, we will be back with another episode of Hidden Files next week with another story from another corner of this vast world of ours that has so much more going on than the titles from the mainstream media. Stay curious.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the United States, Representative Liz Cheney has drawn most of the attention in the race for Wyoming's lone congressional seat thanks to her vocal denunciations of former President Donald J. Trump. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Trip Gabriel. The piece is titled, "Lawyer Who Defeated Cheney's Spent Career Fighting Environmental Rules." Representative Liz Cheney has drawn most of the attention in the race for Wyoming's lone congressional seat thanks to her vocal denunciations of former President Donald J. Trump and what she describes as the threats to democracy posed by his far-right followers. But the challenger who unseated her in Tuesday's Republican primary, Harriet Hageman, has a track record in Wyoming of fierce advocacy on issues particularly relevant to the state's ranchers, as well as energy and mining interests. She spent decades as a trial lawyer fighting environmentalists in America's least populated state and opposing federal rules protecting land, water, and endangered species. Her most far-reaching case was a successful challenge of Clinton-era federal regulations to protect millions of acres of national forests from road building, mining, and other development. A federal judge placed an injunction under regulations in 2003. Harriet Hageman also represented groups that sought to remove protections for the gray wolf under the Endangered Species Act and allow the state to manage hunting. As an unsuccessful candidate for governor in 2018, she suggested transferring 1 million acres of federal land to the state, which opponents warned would have led to selling off prized hunting, fishing, and hiking areas. She has a long reputation among the conservation and sportsman groups of being an anti-federalist, particularly when it comes to ownership of land, said Dan Smitherman, the Wyoming State Director at the Wilderness Society. Most of the main conservation groups and probably 50 to 60% of the sportsman groups assume will be playing defense against her when it comes to public land issues and perhaps some issues like wolves and bears.